from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Trump meets Ryan, Sanders wins again, transgender policy in public school bathrooms, Olympic scandal, trouble in Brazil. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump met with House Speaker Paul Ryan yesterday. It's been frosty. Ryan now says he's encouraged.
I think we had a very encouraging meeting. Look, it's no secret that Donald Trump and I have had our differences. We talked about those differences today.
A new directive from the Obama administration to public schools: let transgender students use bathrooms and locker rooms that match their gender identity. CBS News' Margaret Brennan.
The new directive comes amidst the administration's legal fight with North Carolina over its new law, requiring people to use the bathroom corresponding with the sex on their birth certificate.
And Brazil's Senate voted to suspend President Dilma Rousseff for the beginning of an impeachment trial. Rousseff called it a coup.
When an elected president is stripped of her mandate for a crime she did not commit, the name that is given in the democratic world is not impeachment, it is a coup.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Jenna Johnson of The Washington Post, Michael Crowley of Politico, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What are you watching this week? The new bathroom rules for schools, Trump and Ryan's attempt at unity, Brazil? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Jenna Johnson, political reporter for The Washington Post. Jenna, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Great to have you here. Also from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
Hi. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Jenna, and Michael.
Let's go right to those two in Washington yesterday. The big convoy of black SUVs headed to the Paul Ryan's, to the meeting place anyway. After that meeting, eventually Ryan came out, told reporters that, seeds are being planted here.
I was very encouraged with what I heard from Donald Trump today. I do believe that we are now planting the seeds to get ourselves unified, to bridge the gaps and differences.
And Donald Trump says we will get there.
I think for the most part we agree on a lot of different items, and we're getting there. I feel very strongly about border security. I feel very strongly about trade. I feel very strongly about building up the military. And, you know, to a large extent, I think Paul is there also. So yeah, we'll get there.
Donald Trump talking with Fox News' Sean Hannity last night. So, Jenna, what just happened? Ross Douthat, that headline, conservative columnist's headline is "The Party Surrenders." Is the party surrendering to Trump, unifying with Trump? How do you read it?
Well, you know, everyone's surrendering a little bit. Yesterday was the day that both sides seemed to decide, you know what, we're going to get along even if we don't want to. And you have Paul Ryan and Republicans on the Hill who have been very alarmed by some of the things that Donald Trump has been saying, especially when it comes to the ban on Muslims that he's called for. And on the other side, you have Donald Trump, who up until this week had made clear that he's not going to change who he is. He's not going to change his stances on positions. And this week, ever since you saw this big meeting, you're starting to see him say, you know what, my ideas are suggestions. I'm flexible. I'm open to discussion. I'm looking to work with people on this.
But where's the line in the GOP? We saw the Never Trump movement, and it was big, and it went right up, I don't know if to the top, but very near it. We saw Paul Ryan come out very strongly on issues of ethnic identity and immigration and the Muslim ban. I mean, at this point, Jenna, where's the line? Is everybody going to step over it and get on the Trump bandwagon? We still don't have the Bushes. They're not attending. Mitt Romney, he's not in. Where's the line?
Well, you know, for a lot of people who are deciding to get on board with this campaign, they're doing so with a lot of disclaimers. A lot of times they're really focusing on Hillary Clinton, that they might not like Donald Trump, but that they think that he would be better than Hillary Clinton. And that's what you're really seeing. I think it's going to be interesting to watch over the next few weeks how many of these lawmakers are actually going to be out there on the trail with Donald Trump. How many of them are going to be, taking to the airwaves to support him and to defend him?
Jack, what do you see coming here? By the time we get to the convention or to the fall, all arms linked, and it's a Republican United Front? Really? After all the super bad blood we've seen?
Well, you know, I do think that the New York Times especially has overdone this schism in the Republican Party. I mean, there are five Republicans, by my count, who have come out unequivocally against Trump, five elected Republicans. The whole conservative movement is against him, practically, but that's a different thing. But among elected officials, I only count five who've made Sherman-esque-like statements. Never. And you heard, I think, from Paul Ryan yesterday that, you know, we're on a process and we're going to get there. So I think that's been overdone. What hasn't been overdone or sufficiently emphasized is the schism, not between Trump and elected Republican leaders, but between those elected Republican leaders and Trump's voters. Again and again in these polls in these states that Trump has won, majorities of his voters have said they feel betrayed by their elected officials, partly because they didn't, you know, eliminate Obamacare or roll back the Obama administration. That was impossible. But also because for a generation, the Republican Party has had nothing to say to the diminishing life chances of these people. The steady Republican diet has been Reaganomics, cuts for the, you know, job creators, deregulation, and nothing for the average, for the sort of white working class voter who's going to Trump. So that's the big schism, I think.
Michael Crowley, I know foreign affairs is your portfolio, but you know Washington well. You're watching all this. Do you think that the GOP mainstream can take on the coloring of Donald Trump, or will be willing to, whatever you want to call that coloring? You know, he hasn't been orthodox. He certainly hasn't lined up with traditional conservative principles and policy necessarily. Will they try and slip into that glove, or to change the glove over time?
Well, to some degree, I think they will, as all politicians do, blow in the wind. So they're going to look at the numbers. And, you know, if it looks like Trump has, you know, real support, particularly within their party, particularly within base, among base voters who are going to be turning out in Republican primary elections, who may in some cases like Trump more than a member of Congress who has to make a decision about Trump, they will act accordingly. And if it looks like Trump is dead in the water, you're going to see them flee. You know, that's obviously a pretty basic tenet of politics. There's also a kind of, you know, in the same boat together quality here. Trump, it looks like it's going to be impossible to knock him off the ticket. So they are going to be running with Trump on a ticket in November. And the question is, you know, what image do you want the party writ large to have? And you can try to break decisively for him and say, you know, you vote for me, but not for the party's nominee. But I think there's concern that that's a tough argument to make. Finally, I have to tip my hat to Chuck Todd of NBC, who made this point, and I thought it was an interesting one. They may be thinking about the possibility that, you know, if Trump goes down in a blowout and these guys have distanced themselves from him, fine. You know, they can say, we told you so. But again, if it looks like – if it's going to be a close race and Trump winds up losing in November narrowly, it's going to be easy for him and others to point their fingers at any Republicans who sat on the sidelines and said – if you guys had just gotten with the program and we had been unified, Trump could have won. Last really quick point is, remember, to that point, there's a lot of Republicans who want jobs. There are a huge number of jobs in a new administration. And so there's a real gravitational pull for people to say, hey, you know, the levers of power could be accessible to me. Again, if it looks like this guy has a shot, there are real rewards. Good jobs in government, which unfortunately translate into high-paying jobs in the private sector afterwards. So there's a strong pull.
You wonder, though, if they're going to end up running with Trump, where exactly they will be running. I mean, Donald Trump this week, he had said earlier and taken a lot of heat, including from Paul Ryan, talking about a ban on Muslims. This week in one interview, he said that was just a suggestion. Talking with Fox News' Greta Van Susteren, he was asked about it as well. Here's Greta and then Trump.
So it's a ban on Muslims with exceptions, and that would be temporary.
Of course, always have to have exceptions.
Okay, well, the way that everybody read it was across the table.
No,
that
you'd have exceptions, but ideally you won't have a ban very long. I mean, we just have to find out what's happening.
Of course, elsewhere he said, well, that was a suggestion. I mean, we heard him there in that earlier piece of tape, Jenna, saying, well, I talked with Paul Ryan about border security and trade and building up the military. We have things we can agree on. Is it possible that Donald Trump comes around and becomes a standard cookie-cutter Republican? After all this, it's hard to picture.
Well, you have to keep in mind that a big key to Donald Trump's success is that he's not a politician, that he's not part of the Republican establishment. A lot of voters really, really like that about him. They like that he says what they're thinking. They like that he comes out with these very bold ideas that seem like dreams, but that he promises to do them for them. And he can't just walk away from that. A big part of who he is being an outsider. But I think he's also starting to realize that he's likely headed into a general election, and he wants to win. He wants to be president. And he's going to have to moderate on some of these very, very firm stances that he's taken.
Here's another guy who would like to win. He won this week. Bernie Sanders, West Virginia, was all his. Here he is looking ahead.
If we do well in the coming weeks in Oregon, in California, in New Jersey, in Kentucky, and the other states, we still have that road to victory in winning the majority of pledged delegates.
Road to victory. Is it still out there, Jenna? Can you see it? You have a compass?
Well, he thinks that there's a road to victory out there, and a lot of his supporters think that there's a road to victory out there. But gosh, that road is getting very, very, very narrow. He would have to win pretty much just a large percentage of all of the delegates that are still up for grabs, and then would have to get other delegates to change their minds.
Give Bernie Sanders his due. He was winning this week, and there's a lot of talk about more victories to come for the Sanders camp. That campaign by no means over. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news, Trump and Ryan meet new national directive on bathrooms and transgender students. Of course, we all heard about the impeachment in Brazil, the doping scandal in Russia, bloody, bloody Baghdad this week, and much more. Those fires under control, we're told, up in Alberta. But boy, that was something near the tar sands. You can join us this hour. What do you think? Will the Republicans be one big happy family when it comes to election time? Can you picture how this new bathroom policy for transgender students, all public schools, how that will work? Is Washington right to be setting out new rules for the country on this? And between Zika and impeachment, can Brazil pull off the Olympics this summer? Jenna Johnson is here, political reporter for The Washington Post. Michael Crowley from Politico, senior foreign affairs correspondent, and our own Jack Beatty calls for all of you. Carl in Nashville. Carl, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you very much. Like Jack said, and this is keep going over people's heads, the Republicans are more unified than they're putting on. Only five congresspeople have really just said out, elected congresspeople have said that, hey, I'm not voting for Donald Trump. What's going on is this. The Republican Party's whisper campaign that they've used over the years against the quote-unquote other is out. They've been exposed as the racist party that they've always been. And Donald Trump is just saying it loudly, and they're a little embarrassed and shocked and stunned that someone is actually saying what they what did one of your guests said, that his voters love him because he's, quote, saying what they've been thinking? And that's what and who they are. And no one has answered me this question, Tom.
Okay.
As a Republican, you had the choice to choose between a staunch conservative, like you always wanted, like Ted Cruz, or a xenophobic racist, and your party chose the racist. So what are you? You are what you are.
Carl, I appreciate your call. Jenna Johnson, this idea that the Republicans are more unified than they've been letting on. I mean, our caller Carl goes right down and says, well, this gets to some shared beliefs, stated or unstated. But I've heard an awful lot of woe and dismay that looks to me like much more than theatrics as we've gone along this long path with Donald Trump out front now.
Yes. I mean, a lot of people have been very offended by a lot of the things that he has said and a lot of the things that his supporters have said up to this point.
But Carl says, come on, that is a big chunk of the GOP. That is he would maybe say the heart of the GOP.
Yeah. I mean, Donald Trump is the likely nominee. He has gotten the most votes. Republican voters across the country have picked him as the guy that they want. And this came in a year when the Republican Party was going to try to make some changes. They were going to try to reach out to Latino voters. They were going to try to soften their tone a little bit on immigration issues. And they basically got this pushback from the voters across the country who said pretty clearly that they do not want a lot of these illegal immigrants in their country. They're fearful of refugees coming from places like Syria. And they voted for a candidate who backs their fears and their beliefs.
Jack, what about it? Do you see a stripping, a takeover by Donald Trump here of the GOP, or a stripping away of, down to what's already been there?
I think there's a strong element of that of the latter, that he's showing them a face of the GOP, not the face, but a face.
Yeah.
You know, take the Muslim ban, which is, of course, the most controversial or among the most controversial of his proposals. According to exit polls, two-thirds of Republican primary voters favor that. They favor essentially an unconstitutional religious test to admit people into the United States. That I don't know whether you call that racism or not, but that's just about as radical an idea and a talk about othering. You basically say to 1.2 billion people, you are the other. We don't want you here in America. That looks like a pretty extreme policy move by Mr. Trump, and one he's defending equivocally. It's a suggestion, and then, you know, really with Trump, there's a Shakespearean dimension to his campaign, not the comedy of errors, but rather a quotation from Midsummer Night's Dream: "To give air to airy nothing a local habitation and a name." That's what he keeps doing. He keeps saying, "Well, it's a suggestion here, or it's something else there." You don't know what he's saying, but he does seem to have a will to defend the Muslim ban because it does reflect what the voters wanted.
Doug in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Doug, you're on the air.
How you doing today, Tom?
Okay.
Hey, as far as Trump goes, a lot of people don't like him because he's kind of brash, but he's a businessman. All we've had throughout history here is lawyers, and we see how well that's worked out. I mean, our country is falling apart. At least he acknowledges things that other people didn't before, and now they're all jumping on the bandwagon, and he has some good ideas. Let's give a businessman the opportunity.
Hey, Doug, let me ask you, I can see some ways in which our country is falling apart. I've seen some bridges and roads for sure. But what do you think he'll help the country come together at the same time? Will he do that, or will he drive the people of the country apart, Doug?
Oh, no, I think he'll bring the people together once they see what he's trying to do and how he's trying to do it. I mean, you say don't close the borders, let everybody come in. Well, countries have been taken down by immigration. Look at Europe. Look what's happening in Europe. That's going to happen here. And when people are coming across the border and there's no control, it's chaos. We don't know who's coming across. They're not vetting people. They say, well, we're vetting them. Well, how are you vetting someone who you don't even know their real name?
Well, of course, they've come out and explained in great detail how they're vetting refugees and so on, but maybe not to your satisfaction. And I get that, Doug. I mean, Michael Crowley, you see people looking at Europe now with the problems it's had with immigrants, and there's our caller, Doug, in Minnesota, saying, no thanks, not here.
Right. And, you know, Trump is definitely part of an international phenomenon, which is a rise of a kind of nationalist populism or populist nationalism. I don't know which order to put it in. Closing borders. There's a sense throughout the Western world that, look, at a time of economic distress, which always brings out this xenophobia in populations, that outsiders are swarming in and they are taking jobs, undermining communities, you know, creating crime. So it's not just an American phenomenon. And I think, unfortunately, the two kind of – there's a kind of synergy between this movement in Europe and in the United States. I think European leaders – you know, I think anecdotally, I hear this from European politicians. They see Donald Trump. They see how effective he is. It puts wind in their sails, and it creates a kind of international climate of hostility toward outsiders, which unfortunately could get worse before it gets better.
I mean, watch out. You may look at that and see some disarray, but on the other hand, nationalist kind of xenophobia can go right into racism. Be careful. We have a very diverse country here and have for a long time. You know, we've got more on the I want to get to Hillary Clinton and what she said about Medicare this week. I want to look more at Bernie Sanders. But this issue of the federal government coming in this week on transgender students in public schools in this country and the bathrooms and locker rooms there, even before that came out, we had this news conference earlier in Raleigh, North Carolina, Monday, when the governor there, Pat McGrory, explained North Carolina's lawsuit against the Justice Department. They're now suing each other over this issue at the college level. Here was Governor McGrory.
We believe a court, rather than a federal agency, should tell our state, our nation, and employers across the country what the law requires.
Okay, but today this letter is out, just came out. I've got a copy in my hand from the Department of Justice, Civil Rights Division, and the Department of Education, Office for Civil Rights. Dear colleague, it begins, and they're talking right away about Title IX and reminding people that Title IX encompasses discrimination, they say, based on a student's gender identity. That's their reading of the law, and they want to bring that right in to public schools and how transgender kids are able to use the facilities there. Here's a reaction from one principal in Westport High School, Florida, talked with NPR's Morning Edition today about the new directive. She said that her school district does not yet allow students to use the bathroom corresponding to their gender identity, but they do make accommodations, she said, on a student-by-student basis. You'll hear host Renee Montaigne first.
Effectively, is this just all in flux? There's no real answer. It's right in the middle of just everybody's trying to figure it out.
I think so. And I think that, we're at one of those places historically where we are dealing with how do we make the how do we create a positive learning environment for all of our students?
So there's the situation. Everybody now waiting to see exactly how this will roll out. Jenna, you're there in Washington. Why this? Why now? I mean, I'm reading this morning that this has been planned for some time. It's not just a doubling down on the North Carolina fight here. But what's the impetus behind this right now?
Well, we've been seeing this sort of legislation popping up in a lot of states the last couple years. Maryland, here in the D.C. area, you know, handled some transgender issues during their last legislative session. And basically what's happening is that when it comes to LGBT issues, gay marriage for a long time was the big battle. And with the Supreme Court decision on that, the discussion has really moved on to transgender rights, an issue that has kind of not gotten very much attention the last few years. And states are having to decide how to treat their transgender individuals and what sort of facilities they have set up. And, you know, this is new territory.
Well, I mean,
for a long
it was
time.
States. Now it's federal, right? They just rolled in a big way. I mean, you know, with Title IX, the threat, of course, is it's not required by with the force of law. But if you don't roll with their policy, you face lawsuit. You face loss of money, potentially. It's a big decision, Jack, and a big decision in a big election year.
A big decision and affecting a very small number of people. Out of a school population of 2,000, experts say only 2 to 4 students, 2 to 4 out of 2,000, will be transgender students. And that made just the micro-minority quality of this, I think, made Loretta Lynch's comment this week, at least to this listener, moving, and among the most moving things said by any official in the Obama administration. She looked at this tiny group of people who feel obviously scorned and have had very little respect from their institutions, and said, "We hear you. We in the Justice Department hear you. We stand with you, and we will protect you." You know, that's sort of what we thought civil rights was all about, protecting the rights of even, I won't say despised, but perhaps scorned and mocked minorities. The debate now will really break down over issues of, or be posed over issues of dignity. The dignity of these students wanting to, you know, follow through on their gender identity versus the dignity of the students who don't want to, you know, shower with such people or be in the same bathroom with such people, and their dignity relating to their, quote, bodily privacy. That seems to be the new phrase.
Let's go to Edith in Canton, Connecticut. Edith, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, John.
Hi.
My question is, I don't know what problems have arisen to date other than what was just described as young people not wanting to shower in the same shower during gym, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know who is a transgender. I don't know when I go into a female bathroom and have privacy.
Yep.
Who is in there that was formerly a male?
So are you saying you don't care, Edith, or is this the right policy or not, to your mind?
Right now, I don't see it as a huge problem. If a male came into a female bathroom now, he would be arrested. If a male who was formerly a female and has to show her identity, posing as a man but born as a female, she would have to go into their respective bathrooms. I don't understand how this will play out. I think it's being given much too much publicity right now because until there is a problem that should be dealt with at the time, I don't see this as a problem.
Edith, we've got it. Though if you're in a public facility like that just out in the world, it's one thing. If you're in a school where people have known you, let's say, as a male, and then suddenly you're presenting as female, or vice versa, you can see how it may not be so easy for a kid just to roll into another identity and roll into the other bathroom. I guess that's what they're looking to address here. But on the other hand, as Jack says, you've got all the rest of the kids trying to figure out their sense of security and ease as well. Appreciate your call, Kathy in Victoria, Texas. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I have a personal kind of issue that I just haven't heard addressed.
Okay.
I have a 32-year-old son who was born my daughter.
Okay.
And always very, very masculine.
Mm-hmm.
And before he transitioned about 5 years ago, he was arrested, or not arrested, but had the police called on him several times for using a women's bathroom, which would have been his assigned at gender at birth bathroom.
Because he was born female, and but looked masculine or looked male to the...
Always looked super masculine. Yeah,
yeah,
always really looked masculine.
Yeah.
And women would panic when he walked into the bathroom. I guess my question is, what do people... I mean, I don't think people have thought that through, how a woman's going to feel when somebody who is a man now or, you know, looks just like a man walks into the bathroom.
What about when he was in school? Was it a problem, Kathy, when your then daughter now, I don't know when he transitioned, but were there problems for him?
The odd thing was because he hadn't transitioned in high school, but he still looked very masculine. He had just grown up, you know, with these students who just knew him as a girl, but a very masculine girl.
Yeah.
So we never had an issue there.
Kathy, I really appreciate your call. Michael Crowley, you're listening here. Do we have the cultural flexibility to take this on board and roll with the full richness of gender identity? It's more subtle than that male or female sign on the door sometimes. Are we up to it as a country? We're being asked to be up to it right now by the Obama administration in our schools.
Yeah, Tom, you know, I'm just struck by how fast attitudes are changing. We may be. I think this conversation would have been maybe not impossible 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago. And I think I have to say I was struck by, particularly the first caller who respectfully didn't sound to me like she was a teenager or in her 20s, being very open-minded about this. Because what I would say generally is that I think there's a real generational divide. And for younger Americans, they are just in a very different place than older Americans. But there's an anecdotal evidence that it stretches across generations in a striking way.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In other news this week, John Stewart threw his two cents into 2016 politics, turning his attention to Donald Trump.
He is a man baby. He's has the physical countenance of a man and a baby's temperament and hands. So,
oh boy, John Stewart back right there. The fire that caused the massive 2013 explosion at a West Texas fertilizer plant ruled intentional, criminal. ATF Special Agent in Charge Rob Elder at a press conference Wednesday.
The fire has been ruled as incendiary. This means this fire was a criminal act.
That was some enormous, enormous blast. And Golden State Warriors' Stephen Curry became the NBA's first unanimous choice as MVP.
I looked at the list of everybody who's won an MVP before, legends, guys that their name are household names, and to be the first unanimous MVP award winner is something that I don't even know how to put into words.
Stephen Curry right there. We're looking at a week in the news. Trump and Ryan meeting, new national directive on bathrooms and transgender students, an impeachment in Brazil, doping scandal, and more tension there with the United States over deployment or plans to deploy missiles near Russia. You can join us this hour. Can you picture how this new bathroom policy will work? Between Zika and impeachment, can Brazil pull off the Olympics this summer? After the latest doping news, should Russian athletes be there? And are you worried that the country, the United States, was duped on the Iran nuclear deal? Or are those allegations just part of the whole big debate there? Michael Crowley is with us, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Jenna Johnson is here, political reporter for The Washington Post. Jack Beattie is here. A couple more on how we handle the bathrooms in public schools after this big national directive. William in Nashville, Tennessee. William, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. I just don't feel that this has been well thought through. I think there was a rush to activity to try to help transgender people. I've got two daughters that are teenagers and a mom who's 80, who's a retired Episcopalian minister, and I never walk in the bathroom with any of them naked. I'm always very careful to respect their privacy. We recently had a situation here in Nashville where there was a man who considers himself transgendered who came down to the YMCA in a dress with a wig and a bra,
yeah,
and walked into the women's locker room while, I don't know, 50, 75 women of all ages and nationalities and everything are changing clothes and coming out of the shower. And they were just petrified, all ages. And they're like the big hairy guy walking around as if he's got every right to do so. And I just think there has to be more consideration to everybody's feelings here. And if you just look at the transgendered people and you don't look at the people who have an entire history behind our society of respecting privacy, but that's a bad mistake.
We're going to give it a full hour on Monday in this hour, William. So we'll give it more attention right there and right then. Let me hold your call and get one more, if I may. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing people are concerned about. Sarah in Westwood, Massachusetts. Sarah, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, this is Sarah. Massachusetts, when it adopted the original transgender rights bill back in 2011,
okay,
led to the State Department of Education adopting guidelines on the full inclusion of transgender students in Massachusetts public schools. Those guidelines have been in effect for now 5 years, and there are no problems. Schools have learned quite well how to bring transgender students into the life of public schools.
Sarah, are you aware of how that works exactly? Do they have to go into private facilities, or do they share the common bathroom or locker room?
No, they do not. They do not go into private facilities because to force a transgender student to use a segregated bathroom just further isolates the student. The guidelines make it clear that no, if you are a transgender girl, you use the girls' room. If you are a transgender boy, you use the men's room.
And it just works. I mean,
it's been working quite fine. And there are about 17 or 18 other school districts across the country that have similar guidelines affecting about 750,000 students. And we're not finding at the school level, the schools, the teachers, the administrators, the parents of the kids work together to make it work.
Sarah, I appreciate your call and the report on how that's working in one state. We'll get a chance to see how it works in 50 states, I guess, Jack, though presumably there, it's hard to imagine that we won't see challenges here. I mean, North Carolina already challenging in the courts on the university front. I'm imagining somebody somewhere, maybe a lot, will challenge on this front.
Oh, yes. It's going to join a line of challenges to executive overreach, as conservatives say, of the Obama administration. One conservative member of Virginia school board said, is there anything the federal government does not dictate? And so we're going to this is going to be heard in the courts. However, you know, the courts have found, or at least one of the courts has found, an appeals court, I think, that the kind of law that North Carolina passed is in direct tension and contradiction with the 14th Amendment, which applies against the states. And it says no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And on that's the strength of that. This court said that the something like the North Carolina ruling was unconstitutional.
I'm going to bring it back home, but we have things we have to look at abroad this week. Brazil, big action there with the president, Dilma Rousseff, who, of course, came after Lula da Silva. They had left-leaning administrations, a dozen years there, been in power. And now impeachment moves against her. Yesterday, she gave a televised address after senators there voted to suspend her for an impeachment trial. She's now looking at that trial. Here's Rousseff, interpreted by the BBC.
My government has been undergoing sabotage, and the aim is to prevent me from governing and trying to create a propitious environment for the coup.
Michael Crowley, help us here. They say impeachment. She says coup. We've all seen Brazil go from, you know, super economic performer for a long time as one of the BRICS, you know, to trouble. And then we got all this Zika problem around them. The Olympics are coming. We see problems around that. What is going on in Brazil, Michael?
Well, you put your finger on the bigger picture here, which is that, you know, Brazil a decade or so ago was one of the great global success stories. They had economic growth of over 7% in 2010. This year, they're at about minus 4%.
Ouch.
They are one of many countries that has been really hammered by the decline in oil prices globally, which is really shuffling geopolitics in all kinds of incredibly significant ways. What's happening with Rousseff here is there are kind of a couple things going on that are related. I mean, this impeachment sort of officially, technically, is about the way she is alleged to have improperly shifted money around from government banks to fill budget shortfalls and pay for social programs in a way she says has been done before and her opponents say essentially amounts to corruption. But it comes in the larger context of massive corruption scandal at the country's national oil company, Petrobras, which Rousseff actually chaired. The former treasurer of her Workers' Party, which has been in power for the last 13 years, has been imprisoned as part of this scandal. So it comes amid a general sense that she has presided over this kind of culture of corruption and has a lot of cronies that have been ripping off the country. You know, coup is something we actually heard from defenders of Bill Clinton when the Congress was trying to impeach him in the 1990s. I think that's sort of inevitable when you have a political process trying to remove someone from power. I don't know how much sympathy there is for her. The last approval rating I could find for her was 13%. I know at one point it was in single digits in the last year or two. It was down at like 5%. She's highly unpopular. And I think the result we'll see now is a potential shift to a more conservative government. Her at least interim predecessor is center-right, already under criticism for forming a cabinet that is all male, mostly older white men, not representative of that country's population. But again, as you put it, the bigger story here is a success story, a booming economy, now in dire trouble. Zika, it's not at all clear how they're going to handle it. There are increasing calls for the Olympics to be moved. Just total chaos, and you have to feel for that country of 200 million people.
People saying, why should the Olympics come into Brazil, bring in 500,000 people from around the world, potentially be exposed to the Zika virus, and then go home and maybe take it with them? On top of all that, for the Olympics now, you've got this story, big story that's come out about doping in among the Russian athletes in the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi, at least 15 medal winners. The allegation is part of a state-run doping program, and the guy who ran the laboratory testing against doping, hypothetically, as is the one who's coming out and saying this and is sort of bringing in a lot of the biggest stars, Russian stars, of those Olympic Games. It's kind of bursting out all over right now. Here's a little bit. This is from Vitaly Stepanov, low-level employee in Russia's anti-doping agency, but married to one of Russia's top runners. Here, he and she became whistleblowers. Here he was on CBS's 60 Minutes on Sunday.
There was a situation when I was offered a bribe by the vice president of the federation. Just like that person comes to me and he says, this athlete cannot be tested. How much money do you need?
Michael Crowley, is there talk of some kind of, I don't know, collective punishment of Russian athletes at the Summer Games, wherever they end up being held because of this?
There's absolutely talk of it. I don't know enough about how the system works to tell you whether it's plausible, but there's real outrage over this. There are calls for retribution. And, you know, it's just amazing. It's a throwback to the Cold War. Of course, the Soviets were sort of notorious for at least suspected doping at the time. And, you know, I see this through the kind of geopolitical frame of Vladimir Putin. There's no evidence that he is behind this, but we are at a moment where Russia is aggressive in all kinds of ways in its foreign policy. And Putin is clearly trying to raise the profile of his country on the world stage. The Olympics obviously were hugely important to him when they were in Sochi. He invested billions of dollars to put on a fantastic global show. And, yeah, you know, this is sort of seems consistent with bold Russian behavior in the last few years, but also a throwback to the bad old days of the Cold War.
Watch this space. Maybe more implications, ramifications of the doping allegations right there. Michael Crowley, we have to ask you about one more on the Russian front. We've got Russia really making a lot of new noise this week about American plans to put missiles very close to their borders. What is going on there? I mean, Putin even today making a lot of angry noise about this. There's talk about the threat of nuclear war or, you know, countries left in smoking ruins. Who's pushing what where and why the response now?
Well, I think both sides are pushing each other. What you have is a kind of escalation in Eastern Europe along Russia's border. NATO is and the U.S. are kind of arming up and increasing their defensive posture there, largely as a result of Putin's aggression in Ukraine, his annexation of Crimea in 2014, and this continued sort of de facto military invasion of Eastern Ukraine. And that has NATO allies along Russia's eastern border kind of saying, help us. He's coming for us next. And
the U.S. doesn't say it's about that. They say these are anti-ballistic missile systems against rogue states, particularly Iran. They never name Russia, do they?
That's right. So what's happening generally, there is a military buildup in Eastern Europe. Specifically, what happened on Thursday was the U.S. began operating an anti-missile system in Romania. That's the country that a Russian commentator speculated could wind up in smoking ruins. Ostensibly, this is to defend against Iran. Russia says there are all kinds of ways in which it threatens Russia, even if that's the intent. Its radar monitors Russian airspace. It could be equipped with offensive, not defensive missiles. And I just, you know, what we have generally, this comes in the context of a kind of a tit-for-tat buildup, Russian planes buzzing American ships,
yeah.
The real potential for an escalation, which some people worry could get out of control inadvertently, and that would be a very dangerous thing.
Tracy in Boston, thank you for calling, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just had a comment about the people killed in Baghdad. I think there were 90 people that were killed in Baghdad.
Or more. Yes, a lot this week.
Or more, right. And I think I feel a little sad that when 90 people are killed in Baghdad, it's not as big a deal as when people are killed by terrorists in the United States or in Europe. And that's my comment. And that's really all I wanted to say.
We've got it, Tracy, and I'd appreciate it. I mean, there's been this string of bombings and, you know, a string of anything, and people start to look the other way, especially after war. But nevertheless, you're right. These are big numbers, and they're disconcerting. We had Major General Gary Valesky briefing Pentagon reporters Wednesday about those bombings, saying everything's under control here. Don't worry about it.
As we've seen, as the enemy loses more and more terrain, they resort to some of these desperate acts. The security forces in Baghdad have the situation under control.
The suggestion there, ISIS is losing territory, so they're taking these desperate steps to land a blow where they can. Do you buy that, Michael Crowley?
Well, I think you have to look at it with a very skeptical eye. People may recall, I think it was Donald Rumsfeld or maybe Dick Cheney who said we were seeing the last throes of the insurgency in Iraq sometime around 2004. There, you frequently hear the analysis that that violence like this is a sign of the enemy's desperation, and it often turns out not to be the case. Tom, this is a common refrain, and I've, you know, we've had callers raise this point on your show before. These attacks are covered differently. There are all kinds of reasons for it. It's a tragic thing. One of them is it's just not, you know, by the traditional kind of cold-hearted definition of news, it's not as newsworthy when there's a major suicide bomb in Iraq. It's unfortunately a pretty constant refrain, although this was an especially bad day, the bloodiest day we've seen in Iraq this year. You just don't have the kind of cultural and economic ties that you do to a place like Brussels or Paris. But unfortunately, there is a sort of selective sympathy, and it's really worth pausing and reflecting on because, you know, every life should be treated equally. But it's a sort of unfortunate reality of how the news is covered in the world.
Jack, very quickly, Hillary Clinton this week talking about Medicare for all, at least down to people age 50 or 55 years old. More Sanders pressure as he continues to chalk up yet another victory this week.
Yes, but a significant move for Hillary Clinton. If someone in their 50s could buy into to Medicare. She also came out for the public option, which we remember from the debate over Obamacare, meaning anybody could buy into a public program under the Obamacare. And this comes a week that two studies came out that Bernie's plan on health care falls short by, are you ready, $17 trillion. He can't really say how he'd come up with that hole in the budget. $17 trillion, he can't account for how he would pay for the program.
But a lot of supporters out there saying, look, okay, let's talk about the money, but let's also talk about how things are structured in this country and saying, let's structure them differently. You see, he won again, and by a good margin in West Virginia. She's got the delegates. We'll see where it goes. I want to thank each of you for being with us this week. Michael Crowley, Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for Political. Terrific to have you as always, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us.
Terrific to be here. Thank you, Tom.
Jenna Johnson, Political Reporter for The Washington Post. You'll have your hands full, Jenna. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hey, thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.